This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Matthew Pegas. We're going to be discussing our new mockumentary film, Supply. Matthew, great talking to you.
Great to be on, Robert.
So this is our very first documentary, our first project, one out of many, on Stark Truth TV.
Yes. Hopefully this will be the first of many in a series of documentaries we do on similar themes.
And I've been doing podcasts for quite some time, but Star Truth TV is a continuation of the Star Truth, but onto a cinematographic level. So basically taking what I do in my podcast and putting it out onto video. And it's on YouTube right now, but I don't see it as just a YouTube video. This is a magnificent cinematographic masterpiece.
Yes, it certainly is that. It deserves to be on a much larger screen, but we're kind of conditioned to use what we have, I suppose.
Do you feel that we've gotten the supply that we've rightfully deserved?
Have we? I think that the responses we've got so far have been very, very positive. I think people see it as good work, and I definitely think it was good work. We did a good interview, excellent location scouting, and I think we also, both you and I, did a really good job of editing. So I think what came out was something of a very high quality. And I think that's being recognized. However, it is like an hour and a half documentary. It's not going to be a viral video or anything like that. So while I think the people who see it do like it, I do wonder how, you know, going forward that what the best strategy is to get a great number of people to watch it. There's been a steady trickle of people watching it. Just, you know, it's the question of how do we get that that real supply of, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 views and reposts? I'm not sure about.
Yes, because I set out on this quest for supply, and I met with this spiritual guru, Luke Ford, and I really felt that this man was going to open the door to unlimited supply.
Yeah, well, I mean, as he said, it's not always as simple as, you know, taking a pill, doing one thing, and then your life is transformed. It takes a lot of hard work, so you have to kind of find the more reasonable, healthy goals and work towards those. I mean, I think this is a really important project for us to, you know, establish ourselves and what we're kind of capable of, and even establishing that just for ourselves, and therefore knowing, you know, what to do and maybe what not to do in the future. And I think we could see a really steady climb with this project.
Anyhow, taking a cold shower and stepping out of the vapor, the basic premise of this mockumentary is it is an interview with Luke Ford, and that was our original plan. But then I thought about it. I mean, Luke has been interviewed countless times, so it wouldn't really work if it was just a long interview with him. So what really makes this documentary a masterpiece is the kind of side story. So it is about my personal quest, and I sort of play myself, but it's a character. I mean, I'm using my real name, so I have to say it's myself. I can't just I can't hide behind a character. It's under my name, so anything the character says, I'm accountable for. But anyhow, it's this... I'm in Santa Barbara, and it starts off in Santa Barbara, and I'm talking about my life, and a lot of this does go back to that article you wrote. I do want to talk about this article, because it's about the very first time we met, and you were going up on a trip to the Bay Area, and we met for the first time here in Santa Barbara, and you wrote an article about meeting me, and we kind of discussed these themes about maladaptive daydreaming, the fantasies, and trying to kind of implement your fantasies, and also the feeling that I think a lot of us have, that you have all these great ideas and great visions that are not being implemented, and this kind of sense, it is a sense of narcissism to kind of prove you're great, but also like when you're not, when you're frustrated with that, like the kind of feeling of emptiness. And I think a lot of people, especially in online culture, can relate to that, because we're a lot more creative than your average person, but there is just basic human desire to prove your status. And there's a sense of using your ideas, whether they're aesthetic visions, Your creative output, or political ideas, as not just to make the world a better place in an altruistic sense, or not. I mean, and then there's the creative process, but there is a sense of using that to get supply to achieve status.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it can be said that the internet, you know, we're focused on the alt-right and then other kind of dissident political subcultures online. We're focused on that. But I think it's something that can be said for internet culture as a whole, that it's where you go to when, for whatever reason, the real world isn't working for you in some way. Obviously, everyone uses the internet, but when you really use it as a platform to spread your ideas or your work, it's often in response to not feeling like you're getting that narcissistic supply. You're not feeling properly loved or cared about or respected in the real world, and so you take to the internet to kind of create a space in which you do have status. I mean, you know, like even just me coming on your podcast, I come on here, you're interested in what I have to say. There's the idea that others that are out there, that will be out there listening to this recording, will be interested in what I have to say, and perhaps that's not how I feel on a day-to-day basis, going to work, etc. So that's, I think, a lot of what our documentary was about, was kind of talking about that role of the internet as an outlet for people to achieve narcissistic supply. And I guess I just wanted to comment briefly here that while we are focused on a specific subculture on the internet, some of the critiques we're saying could go for the culture as a whole. I mean, you know, for all the you know young Instagram addicted people, a lot of people have this tension between, you know, the unfulfillingness of their real life and what they might go to the internet for. So I think it's a really important theme.
Yeah, for sure. And we made a conscious decision to not make it explicitly political. I mean, Luke Ford is very political, and most of his live streams are about politics. But we decided to focus primarily on that theme of status, narcissistic supply, maladaptive daydreaming. So it is a very documentary about psychology. And I'd say the majority of the interviews with Luke Ford are about psychology. I did ask him about maladaptive daydreaming. I asked him about the whole theme of having your instincts out of whack. So you have this kind of internal dialogue where you feel very grandiose, and then you get out there in the real world and you feel small and unimportant, and there's this kind of intense conflict and this feeling of being at ease. So we cover a lot of really important psychological themes.
Yeah, it's like we asked Luke about a lot of stuff because Luke is a very multifaceted person. We asked him about working in the adult industry. We asked him about streaming and the alt-right, of course, and his Orthodox Judaism. But underlying everything, our main focus really was psychology and the kind of common threads throughout different elements of his life, the kind of different, you know, the underlying senses of emptiness that may have led him in very different directions. So I would say you're right that that is a... That is probably the central most theme would be psychology, maladaptive daydreaming, narcissism, the quest for narcissistic supply. I think the other really important theme is art and craft and the importance of that. You know, whether it's you talking about your paintings or the documentary itself, I think we really put a lot into making it as aesthetically pleasing as possible. And Luke had a lot of really good and interesting things to say about craft, too. I think one of my favorite lessons I took from it was his whole point about if you're doing good work, if your craft is good, like him with his journalism, it doesn't matter what your motivations are. So even if he had some lascivious is the wrong word, even if he had some motivations he now questions for being involved in the porn industry, even if he maybe has some questionable motivations for his alt-right blogging, there still is something kind of transcendently good about the craft that comes out at the end, the product. And I think it really can, really good journalism and really good art can lead to a greater understanding, which I think is unequivocally a social good.
Yeah, for sure, because there is this narcissistic element towards creation of art, whether it's paintings or music, because you are trying to prove your greatness, but it's also a way to achieve a status. But at the same time, even if that's your motive, you are making the world a better place, because art, it inspires people, and it's a little bit difficult to explain in words, but there's just something transcendent about looking at a beautiful painting, and it can have this really positive impact on people subconsciously. But just like, I have this core belief that aesthetics are what shape the culture, and culture is what shape the politics. So I mean, not everyone's going to, this is kind of my own view, but I believe that if you put out a great aesthetic vision, you can have this impact in making the world a better place.
Yeah, I agree with that too, me with my whole neon nationalism article on Alto Center. I agree. That's been the way I've understood things. And I think that our documentary touches on that too. I'm reminded of the scene in front of the Fountain of You reading from Journey to Vapor Island. I think that's one of the really great segments. You did a great job of finding the place in Beverly Hills to do that. You know, you have this Robin-esque statue and columns in the background, and it really is a scene that kind of harkens back to a older West, magnificent, you might say, or glorious Western aesthetic. That I think the idea is that you, with what you are reading from Journey to Vapor Island, is something that you would like to resurrect, possibly. So I think that,
yes,
for that well.
Sure. And we didn't say this explicitly in the documentary, and I don't think it's necessary. I think we get this across, but it's interesting about Beverly Hills is the aesthetics of the places we visited, whether it's Roman or 80s retrofuturism, it's a very kind of aristocratic aesthetic, but Beverly Hills is basically synonymous with kind of like the liberal capitalist elite, so it does implicitly touch upon that theme of a sort of aristocratic aesthetic versus the current ruling class, which it basically is liberal capitalism.
Yeah, definitely. The irony or the tension is there. I think I would hope that some people were able to pick up on that. I don't think it's extremely obvious, but I don't think it's extremely obvious. But when you kind of think about, you know, what we were doing there, you know, Beverly Hills, but then the Romanesque architecture, the different tensions, and you, of course, reading from that passage, which we purposely made kind of hard to hear because we didn't want to make the documentary too political, but, you know, talking about different classes of people, you know, the masses, and then the kind of false elite and the true aristocratic radical. That was the theme of the passage you were reading there. All of that, I think, plays so well in Beverly Hills as a location of that really does kind of represent an enclave of the false elite, as it were.
Yeah, because that also, the whole kind of philosophy of that quote ties in with status and kind of the concept of loserdom and genuine losers versus situational losers, because there's this kind of, with the thing we've discussed in the past with aristocratic radicalism, there are basically, like, you're just conformist masses in society, which can be basically the lower classes or just regular kind of conformist middle class people. And then there's people who have economic and social status within society. And those are the people who thrive. And that's true because, and same with the politicians who are able to manipulate people to vote for them, or people who can manipulate consumers. And then you get a lot of people who are involved in both dissident politics and avant-garde artist, and they definitely, including myself, have this intense feeling like they have the best political ideas, they have the grandest aesthetic visions, they have the ideas of how a utopian society should work, and a lot of it just sounds really really delusional. But that basically is how society works. Is not so much the best ideas, the best political ideas, or the grandest aesthetic visions, or the most innovative culture rises to the top. Basically, the way you achieve wealth and status within society is you convince a large number of people to support you, either financially, or just to basically be your fan and give you status.
And, so, and the way you do that, especially in such a culture-less or multicultural society, is to appeal to the lowest common denominator. I mean, that's the machinations of capitalism, and especially global multicultural capitalism, which is, I think it's fair to say, pretty much the regime under which we live. There is kind of this alliance between what, you know, we would call the false elite, those who are able to, those who have the wealth and make the products to keep the, you know, the masses placated and dumb. And then, the false elite, the masses, and then, you know, potentially a third class of people that could, I think, could come from either, you know, the false elite class or from the, you know, the proletariat, who understand things in a deeper way. And that sounds really elitist. What I mean more, I don't think, it's not like you're one or the other. I think there's a lot of people who are proletariat, a lot of people who are, you know, part of quote-unquote false elite, who you know, have a little bit of this sense.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a much wider spread thing. I'm not saying, like, oh, I'm not, like, trying to put you and I in, like, an ivory tower looking out over the world, and it's like,
well,
we are the rare ones.
We literally were in an ivory tower looking out over the masses of L.A.
That's true. So obviously, I'll play with that theme, but, like, I'm just trying to make it clear that I don't have too much of a superiority complex. I just think that there is, you know, a false elite and a very dumbed-down mass of people, and then the third position...
I would say about that is I do think there are people who do have wealth and status within society who have some attributes that we have, but they either, if it's about politics, and they have to shut up completely, but maybe it could be, you could be from the economic elites and have some cultural innovative ideas. So not, I agree with you, not everything is black and white. And you can also be from the proletariat and have innovative ideas. So not, it kind of goes, I mean, it would, it kind of, I don't want to get too simplistic, because it's like the manosphere types like to have this whole thing where men are either like alphas, betas, or omegas, and there's characteristics. But I also think, I mean, I think that's a way to, it's too simplistic to just characterize
way too simplistic. Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's not useful, but it,
exactly.
it is yeah
So with this kind of quest for status, a lot of individuals who feel that way, if they fail to kind of achieve greatness, they tend to live in the vapor. And the vapor is obviously, I mean, that's an analogy for my book that's too esoteric, but it's basically an analogy for maladaptive daydreaming. So a lot of people who are creative, they have these great visions. If they fail to implement them practically, sometimes they find it's just easier to kind of live in fantasy and daydream than to actually take a cold shower and to try to make practical steps to improve either your own life or to improve the world as a whole. Because that, I mean, that's very difficult, and sometimes it can be painful because you kind of have to start from scratch, and you kind of have to give up your ego and start from the very bottom. And that, I mean, that can be, for a lot of it, like aristocratic radicals, that can be very humiliating to sort of, because basically you have to kind of give up your illusions of grandeur or just kind of subside them and just like, and that's kind of what Luke was saying, like just start from the basics. Like maybe for some people it might just be getting a job and just moving up kind of the career path. But what Luke was saying, like if you're a podcaster, just make some practical steps. Like say you have 200 people following your live stream or podcast, and your goal should be to move it up to maybe a couple thousand. So just make practical goals, and you just have, kind of have to make those steps. Yeah.
What Luke always recommends, I don't actually do this in my own life, but I think there's something to it, is, you know, the enemy of a lot of personal progress is, you know, the disease of vagueness. So there's really something to be said for writing things down and just making concrete goals. And then when you write things down and make them concrete, it becomes a lot more, or it should, if you're thinking about it healthily, become a lot more easy to think about, like, what's actually feasible. And then go from there. That can be, if I could just, it's a kind of meta thing about the documentary. I mean, working on this documentary for me, and also appearing on your show more recently, it's, you know, these are very concrete and productive actions to take. Obviously, there's been a degree of maladaptive daydreaming that's gotten to the documentary itself. But,
you discussed this in Santa Barbara article. Luke Ford says maladaptive daydreaming is harmful. I have mixed feelings about that because I engage in a lot of maladaptive daydreaming, and it's provided inspiration for podcasts, this documentary, my paintings, my books. So I think maladaptive daydreaming can be channeled into things that are productive, but certainly you just have to kind of put some limitations on it. So maybe set aside like an hour a day for maladaptive daydreaming, and then the rest of the day. But the thing is, if I'm engaging in creative pursuits such as painting, podcast, or writing novels, or working on documentaries, then it's all molded together, and it kind of gets chaotic because you're doing something constructive, but you're engaging in this powerful creative energy which is coming from that maladaptive daydreaming. So it is productive, you're doing something productive, but then it's triggering the more maladaptive aspects. And that, I mean, that's like the essence of being a creative type. But I would say for your average person who has a normal job, and maybe they have a creative hobby on the side, like maybe they like taking photographs, or just maybe they are an artist, but it's just kind of a small side thing. Like or some people don't really... maybe like maladaptive daydreaming is counterproductive. And I think for a lot of people, some people don't even, I think a lot of people, they just like watching TV, and that's actually a lot worse than maladaptive daydreaming, because there's no creativity in that whatsoever.
Oh yeah, I agree. Oh man, I feel like I have a lot to say about what you just said, because it's interesting. But first I'll say that yes, maladaptive daydreaming is integrally connected to the creative process for me, and I would imagine for most for most artists, especially most serious artists. What it is, you know, you talk about it as like a powerful force. I think it, there is a very, there's a great power to maladaptive daydreaming, to what the parts of you that it taps into. Obviously, not all maladaptive daydreaming is sexual or sexual fantasy. A lot of it is. But I've always understood the world, for the while anyway, in terms of you know, erotic energy is kind of at the heart of a lot of human endeavors, I believe. And erotic energy, you know, people describe it as like being a fire inside of you.
Well, that's a huge theme in the documentary, because I talk about, like, getting into Hollywood, going to the top casting agencies, meeting like gorgeous actresses.
Yeah, sex is never far away.
Yeah, it's just motivation
from whatever you're talking
for
about.
Status, yeah. And wealth and creative potential. I mean, it's almost like the cliche of the guy starting a band to get laid. And
yeah, that's a very crude depiction of it. But I mean, it goes to I really do think, the highest level. Not to be too reductionist, but...
Do you think that artwork created by, or music created by a guy who wants to get laid, is it, like, inferior work? Or can it be, or can it still produce work of value?
Oh, I think that it certainly can still produce work of value, and that much of the greatest work of value comes from that erotic frenzy. I really do, but here's the thing: it can drive you insane. Just that energy.
Yes,
and I've
you will find
that.
Yourself stranded in the worst ghetto in the valley with this, with being robbed of your wallet, with no money for Uber, and a sadistic neon clown looking down on you.
Yeah, retracing the steps of Alisa Silverstone. I mean, it drives you mad. But that's the important thing about making concrete goals and doing concrete things, like making art, like making this documentary, is that it calms that frenzy. And we're not just talking about sex here. I'm talking about, I say that with maladaptive daydreaming, there often is a sexual element, but it's also just, it's however you want to put yourself out in the world. There's an erotic element to that, you know, literally with sex and reproduction, but there's a more abstract level to that with politics and with art, where the goal of it is to get yourself out there in some way, you know? Like, it's not to be too crude or simplistic, but, you know, the same way that you would get yourself out by, you know, ejaculating and producing babies, it's similar with creating art. It really is.
What Luke said about his journalism in the porn industry was fascinating, because he said he originally had honorable intentions. Basically, he wanted to explore the intellectual theme of whether sexual liberation was good for society. But then he got enticed by the status and just the erotic energy of being surrounded by these porn stars. And that's understandable, of course.
Yeah. In fairness, he also just said it became a way to earn a living, which I certainly understand.
Yeah,
it's not easy to earn a living as a writer. Yeah.
Definitely. But yeah, that was an interesting point he made. And
definitely.
Then from there, he read this excerpt from Eroticized Rage, where that's a very personal thing. And I guess it does take a lot of... a lot of vulnerability to admit that, like, his darkest sexual fantasies, but just his feeling of powerlessness and using your erotic fantasies and porn and watching certain genres of pornography to sort of feel the sense of power that you're missing in real life. And that's the same, that's sort of the sexual parallel to achieve, using the online world to achieve the status that you're missing in a day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, can it be said that extreme BDSM porn is to, like, really extreme alt-right stuff as, you know, healthy sex is to, like, you know, maybe more in real life healthy political activism? That's very dismissive of the alt-right, but there's a parallel there.
Yeah, for sure. Because
you're seeking out a way to achieve, live out power fantasies that you have in life, but that you can't achieve in life.
And then when you fail to achieve that, your fantasies become darker and darker and crueler until the point where it's like that. What's that film with Jennifer Connelly in that?
Oh, gosh, the name's not... It's an Aronofsky film.
Well, she's a drug addict.
Ah, it's like one of the more famous films of the 2000s. Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I also just want to make it clear, like, I'm not... By saying that, I'm not being totally dismissive of the alt-right or of extreme politics. Frankly, I'm not being entirely dismissive of extreme porn either. I mean, I think it's bad. But I think with all of these things, there's something more to it. There's important insights you can have into human nature and into the nature of politics and sex that you can only get from kind of exploring some of the more extreme stuff. So I just want to make that clear that I'm not being totally dismissive. I'm just saying that it is symptomatic of an immense frustration that people have.
And that's why I think mainstream conservatism has been a failed ideology, which led to the rise of the alt-right, because conservatives are very squeamish, and they don't want to talk about anything that's degenerate, or... I mean, just look at kind of the reaction that conservatives have would be to Milo. Like, Milo made some observations about his experience as a young homosexual, and basically both... I mean, the left attacked him as a political enemy, but mainstream conservatism denounced him as a degenerate because he was just saying something insightful based on his own observations, and conservatives are very morally squeamish. It doesn't matter if you think something's morally right or wrong. They just don't even want to talk about certain topics. And that's why, like, we were kind of discussing this theme with David Cole about conservative entertainment. And that's pretty much why it's failed, because they just want to, like, put out media that basically recreates 1950s media. And
it's a very sentimental, especially in the U.S., very sentimental Judeo-Christian, even specifically Protestant, account of things that just doesn't take into account the darker elements of human nature. I think that's all there is to it. And I think now what the big change over the last 10 years isn't in conservatism, but is in liberalism pretty much doing the same thing.
Yes, because liberalism's become much more neo-puritanical. And when I see the right and the alt-right attacking liberals, their main obsession right now is the whole Pizzagate thing. Like, the left is part of this whole pedophile cabal. I mean, a lot of that stuff is just silly, but I think the main thing about the left today is that it's become sort of a neo-puritanical when someone, like a 70s counterculture icon like Will McBride would be viewed as a degenerate fascist by today's left.
Well, yeah, maybe, or maybe they would find some way to embrace him. The left is very strange on that, where it's like they love you or they hate you. They're incapable of nuance, so it's almost like either this guy's an LGBTQ hero, or he's not that at all, and actually he's a rapist. They're just totally incapable of nuance.
Yes, for sure, and I think, but there's a positive outcome. I mean, we're going kind of off topic from our documentary, but that's fine. But I think this extreme neo-puritanical element of the left is going to drive away a lot of the avant-garde types, and that's a good thing, because then they'll be looking for something new, and so that, I mean, that could actually be a positive trend.
Yeah, definitely could be. That's kind of the route I took. But I don't know if you want to get back on track with the documentary.
Well, this all ties in, because what we're kind of doing with this project, Stark Truth TV, and hopefully we'll be making future documentaries, is kind of to revive that, I want to create something new, I don't just want to copy it, but as a continuation of the 90s apocalypse culture with Answer Me and Feral House.
Yeah, and where I think that Stark Truth TV is a... is an offshoot or is inspired by that is just that idea of exploring what Adam Harpy called areas of forbidden knowledge, just looking at things that have kind of been repressed by the mainstream by polite society, and not taking them at face value per se, not like saying, oh, this is actually right, you know, Pizzagate is real, or, excuse me, we need a white ethnostate. It's nothing like that. But it's looking at those ideas and considering the motivations from which they come, and what to what extent those ideas are stemming from real needs or real real events or real problems in the West, and just all with the goal not to get too humanitarian about it, because I don't really consider myself a humanitarian per se, but there really is something there, an anthropological aspect of kind of promoting deeper understanding. And it's like, even if all this alt-right stuff is not good, then can we at least gain insights from considering that that might point us into in a direction that is good, or that can be added to, other kinds of understandings.
Yes, because let's just say, I mean, the alt-right, they completely fail to have any influence in politics, and the movement is totally marginalized. Just from a sociological perspective, there's so much we can learn about societal changes from analyzing the alt-right.
Yeah, and the biggest lesson that I've always taken from it is just the level of disenfranchisement that I've experienced myself too. Experienced by the young, specifically the young white men of the West, and I mean it's other people too. It's whites of all genders. It's males of other races as well. But just specifically, like, how kind of left behind a lot of white guys around our age feel. I mean, that's just a completely unaddressed. It's an issue that the mainstream is not willing to touch, conservative or liberal.
Yeah,
and it's boiling up into something very, very dark. And I don't want it to be dark, necessarily.
Well, it's a major theme in my book, where the main character, Noam, he kind of doesn't fit in with either group. And I'm not really saying that that character is someone to emulate, but I'm just kind of looking at my experience back in high school. I kind of felt like simultaneously oppressed by, on one hand, there was a kind of the struggle for social status, and I felt oppressed by the popular crowd, but then on the other hand, I felt oppressed by this extreme political correctness and having your teachers talk about, like, white guilt and white supremacy. So you're kind of getting it on both ends.
Yeah, I think there's so many guys our age that have gone through that. For me, it was less in high school as in college, where I went to a school with a lot of fraternities. I was never part of that sort of more like normie, relatively more conservative crowd, and I hung with and I was part of, you know, a lot of the very kind of left-wing crowd. But in the long run, they all sort of fucked me over and didn't really care about what I had to say. Or that's how I felt. That's a little bit of an overstatement, but that's how I felt. And that kind of led me to this third position.
Also think that a lot of nerdy white guys become leftists because they kind of see, like, minorities and transgender people and even feminists as, like, fellow victims of this kind of Chad power structure.
Yeah, well, look, I still, without saying anything that's going to get me, like, blacklisted from any alt-right circles, I still have known a lot of, like, transgender people and stuff, and I'm not saying that people should have any opinion on, a more liberal opinion on that or anything, but, like, I still kind of relate to a lot of just socially outcast people. Where things went really wrong, I think, was with a lot of feminism, especially, it became this province of really cruel, very extroverted women who kind of use it to basically bully a lot of men with whom they might be in competition.
Yeah, we're not. The thing is, we're not really alt-right. We're alt-center, so it's okay to take some more liberal positions and to be open-minded about homosexuals and transgender people. The point I'm just kind of making is you see these parallels. So, I think people like to attack the social status of their political enemies on both, and both sides do with SJWs and the alt-right. But I do think that I look at these guys who become SJWs or Antifa, and they're just these really nerdy guys who were probably bullied a lot in high school. And I just kind of think, like, they see, like, Donald Trump to them maybe symbolizes, like, the Chad,
the Chad who terrorized them
in high school. And then they see, like, minorities as, like, fellow oppressed groups. So it's just kind of, there's just, I mean, there's this concept of intersectionality of, like, women, minorities, and LGBT against white males. But I also think you might get some lower status white males who try to kind of lump themselves into that group. But it doesn't actually, it always backfires because then they say they're an oppressed group. And I mean, I just think one of the best examples of that is, look, if you look at any article from the left covering, like, the incel issue, their response to it almost sounds like a free market capitalist.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And if I could go on a little tangent, I mean, I know we're talking about the documentary, but I've kind of wanted to say this about myself somewhere online for a while, because I think it's kind of an interesting story. I mean, I think what you're saying about lower status males and kind of nerdier white guys who get attracted to SJW culture or even Antifa, I mean, it's very spot on. But I think more and more of them, rather, are starting to realize that they're completely unwanted by this coalition, this SJW coalition. And I think more and more, with Jordan Peterson, not that I advocate everything he says, but I mean, we're seeing more and more of a culture of that demographic switching over. And just to get personal, that is definitely, you know, where I came from, as I sort of alluded to. I was never an SJW. I always had issues with that, but I was, you know, I was of the left. And that's how I ended up discovering your show, was I was a huge fan of the band Shushu.
Right,
because
right.
For me, I was always looking for, I was just embroiled in all these identity politics surrounding me, this victim culture of, you know, all these people that called themselves queer. And I just wanted to have some kind of identity politics of my own, but still in a left-wing context. And so I always looked to the band Shushu, which is kind of, you know, a queer white male lead singer. I always looked to that as a sort of identity politics. And I still was all in a left-wing framework until I found the Shushu interview on your show, and it kind of flipped my perspective entirely because it introduced me to the sort of other side.
I mean,
don't know if that would make sense to most people, but I always want to make some sort of statement about how the band Shushu red-pilled me, because I think it's such a strange thing, but interesting.
I mean, Pill Eater talks about, like, Asian Aryanism, and, I mean, on the surface it sounds like this kind of a kooky, autistic thing for, like, anime nerds, but I think you do get, like, these nerdy white guys who are attracted to that because they're looking for this kind of genuine sense of identity, and they're not getting that out of a mainstream white culture. And even though they're not, they're still identifying with the left on a superficial level. In a sense, they want something that is healthy in regards to both an identity and some kind of healthy gender roles. So I mean, mm-hmm. And we were just walking around Santa Barbara, we were kind of seeing, like, Pill Eater's, like, fantasies being implemented, like, right in front of our eyes.
Oh, the Asian Aryanism thing is insane. I mean, it sounds so kooky, but, and you see a lot of kooky stuff in the dissident sphere, but I mean, Pill Eater is basically, I mean, it's just the number of white male Asian female couples out there. I like, in a lot of urban centers, you basically see more of that than white couples. So there is something to that. And I just want to say, like, I think one of the things to understand is, like, and this ties back into the documentary, everyone just wants, you know, to have their needs met. I mean, that's a basic fact of politics. That's the most basic fact. And obviously there's food and shelter. Those are important. But as Luke says in the documentary, the next thing after that is status. And somewhere tied deeply in with status and all the rest is also sex. So we're all just looking to kind of fulfill those erotic drives we have. I may be talking about Eros too much, but I really think it's a useful concept. We're all just looking to fulfill those drives. That's the basic human impulse. And good political systems, good civilizations, good societies, in my view, make it so that the most number of people, you know, have those things satisfied. Not to sound like a total communist, but I mean, that's how you create stable societies. That's are, not, like, I believe in hierarchy, so I'm not a communist. But that's how you create stable societies, is, you know, is propagating that kind of distribution of resources. And what's happening on the left right now is they're totally depriving white males of any kind of status. It's sex in certain cases. Food and shelter is still there, but you know, when you deprive them of status and sex, they're gonna turn into fascists. That's the inevitable.
Yeah, for sure. So basically, neoliberalism has failed, and it's creating all these disconnected, atomized people. And this, and going back to our documentary and what Luke was talking about, is if you fail to form healthy social bonds, you look for that, you try to fill that void in other ways, either through an addiction, whether it's drugs, alcohol, pornography, extreme politics, or through trying to achieve a narcissistic supply. And I mean, this documentary goes on to greater social commentary. We did touch on this briefly, but as society becomes more atomized, you see more addiction. I think for the working class, like, the opioid addiction is huge, alcoholism is huge, and for more higher IQ people, the big addiction is trying to gain social status online. And you said, like, for more normies, it's like the whole Instagram thing. So you see it, I mean, not just for low status people, even for, like, attractive women, like, their identity revolves around a lot of the cases, like, getting on Instagram and having as many people as possible follow you. So it's really across the board of all walks of life, all political persuasions, all economic classes. We have this society of people who are disconnected. And not just losers. I mean, even people you would think would be somewhat successful. This pretty much transcends beyond pretty much a large swath of our society.
Yeah, no, I think it's always important to remember that. I mean, I think of it as like, alt-right dissident politics, we've all got these problems and we can't relate to the normal world, but the normal world is very much sick with a lot of these same problems. I mean, I don't know how much we want to talk about Instagram culture, but I mean, if you look at that, especially the way women use it, I mean, it's just sad. I was talking with a friend the other day, a female friend, about how, like, women basically use social media to prove to one another that their lives are fulfilling. Like, you just, they'll always be posting, and men do this too, but there is a specifically female thing of, you know, posting, you know, pictures with your boyfriend and, like, picture all these great things you're doing, how happy you are, and just constantly trying to get across how happy you are, which is a way,
yeah,
especially for women, to prove your status. Yeah,
like, a lot of people are now vacationing just so they can, this new trend, just so they can get the right Instagram photos. At least when I go on trips and I do these photo journals, I mean, there is a sense of narcissism, but at least I try to do something productive out of it.
Exactly, yeah. Which brings us back, you know, to the kind of transcendent power of better work. But a lot of online culture is just performance. Now, performance isn't inherently bad, but when you confuse what is performative with what is like real life and what's really important, then you're in deep shit.
Do you want to comment on that video that we used of Greg Johnson and Andy Nowicki?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite little scenes in the car, us watching a YouTube video, you know, a video of a video, a meta video. I just kind of filmed that on the fly.
Why did, like, Pill Eater have to put Amy Schumer in there? That just ruins it.
Well, you know, it's the reality.
It's
pill.
The cold shower.
It's the cold shower. Not all blondes.
I'm looking at Alicia Silverstone, and then that Israeli model from 2013, and then suddenly Amy Schumer comes on and ruins my fantasy.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to keep your fantasies kind of in check. I mean, that was another thing I wanted to say earlier about kind of the craziness that maladaptive dreaming can make you feel, that crazy, fiery energy. It's really, I've been feeling a lot more serene over the past couple months, as opposed to when I first took the red pill. I was, when I first took the red pill, there was a brief harmonious period where I was like, man, this is, this is it. And then I went through some troubled times where I was having a lot of maladaptive daydreams and not feeling like my new understanding of things was leading anywhere. But since kind of meeting you, actually, and being on your show and making the documentary, kind of it's helped me to bring my sort of fantasies and this sense I have of having really important insights and you know, execute them in real life. And real life is always sobering. So that's why I'm making that documentary, coming on this show. It's like, yes, I can talk about this stuff, but I'm, you know, there's checks and balances. I'm not, you know, you don't go out of control when you're talking to another human being, even if it is over the internet. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And with that video, I mean, it's actually not accurate. Greg Johnson thinks Santa Barbara is this utopia of blondes. And he was implying that that would be implying that in a negative way. I mean, I actually wish that were true. It's actually not the case.
Yeah, well, I don't know if Greg Johnson likes... Actually, I know that Greg Johnson doesn't necessarily have the same opinion of blondes as yourself.
Yeah, yeah, he probably thinks they're polluting the Aryan race, but oh well.
Probably. There's more of them in L.A. than in Santa Barbara.
Well, but he lived in Northern California.
Yeah, there's not that many in NorCal.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're probably right, but Alicia Silverstone grew up in near San Francisco.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Yeah. But is there anything you want to talk about? I don't know if you have more questions that you want to go to, but is there anything you want to talk about in terms of some of our process of making this, like our various trips around L.A.?
One last thing I'd like to touch upon is the process in the production of the film. So we did different roles in this. So, Matt, you did primarily the editing and the filming. I did the acting and the location scout work and the kind of... well, we collaborated on art direction, so...
Art direction, and we collaborated on the interview with Luke. It was a very collaborative process, I would say. I handled most of the more technical stuff, but a lot of the vision was owed to you, yeah.
Yeah, so I got to do all the fun stuff, and you did all the hard work.
Well, hey, I helped with the fun stuff, too. I mean, I think both of our visions were executed, and you did help with the editing.
That's true.
I mean, I don't think you knew the software as well as me, but I had you there to consult with, so that was good.
Yeah, anything tech... I mean, I have done video editing in the past, but anything technical with filming or editing just really drives my OCD insane. I mean, you don't have OCD to the degree I do, but I know you've been technically frustrated. There was that incident where we were at a coffee shop and your program crashed and you thought you lost everything.
Yeah, that might be fun to talk about, actually. Or it was not fun at the time. But yeah, my program crashed, and I worried that I lost, you know, maybe 7 or 8 hours. Maybe a little less, but a significant amount of editing.
You poured, like, hot boiling coffee, like, right in my face. It was awful.
That is not true. That's fake news, folks. but I was... The interesting thing about that, just as a little history of making this documentary, that was on the day of Unite the Right 2. And it happened right as I was looking at the headlines, which I think I kind of let them blackpill me more than I should have, because a lot of people think that there was some success to...
That will come later on our...
But I remember seeing the headlines like, oh, you know, Unite the Right 2, an embarrassment, you know, Jason Kessler, blah, blah, blah. And I read that right
at the
program crash, and it was like, all is lost.
Two former guests from the Stark Truth were there.
Yeah, yeah.
Al Stancard and Charles Lincoln.
Yeah, so that was interesting, but we recovered the footage in the end in the editing, so that worked out.
And some of the special effects were pretty cool. So you did this effect. I do want to go back to something that I'll get back to the technical work. I want to comment on something because I show these different personality types. So there's one side of me that I portray that is narcissistic but with a sense of awkwardness. There's this scene where I'm up in that hotel, that penthouse suite up in that high rise, looking down, and I just look this very kind of a cool narcissistic look. And then there's the scenes where I'm talking to Luke and I'm more sobered, and I portray different sides of me, and a lot of it is acting. because I mean, I have taken acting classes, so I mean, it's difficult because it's sort of like I'm playing myself, but it's also a character. But I do believe these are genuinely different sides of my persona that exist, and I'm not going to go on a narcissistic rant like that in real life, like I did in the beginning of the film. But it does reflect, I mean, to be honest, it reflects a lot of my internal dialogue. So all these different parts of my parts portrayed represent different parts of me depending on my mood and how well I'm connecting to people. Because even if you're really connecting to a person on a deep level, a lot of those narcissistic feelings of grandiosity, they kind of subsue.
Yeah, definitely. I agree that we captured different sides of you really well. I'm really happy with the way that it all turned out. Basically, the first 15 minutes and the last, 7 minutes of the film, are, for those who haven't seen it, are focused on Robert, and he kind of walks through different Southern California locations in, as he said, various different sorts of moods or personas. And I think that was the timing of that worked out well, because I think it's just enough so you get a flash of that, get a really good and interesting picture of Robert. Then we jump into the Luke Ford interview, which is I always said this, when we were there with Luke, I just felt so sober inside. You know, there was this great calming influence. I think that plays out in the documentary.
Yes, too. I mean, yeah, I'd almost go as far as almost like this. I did feel like the spiritual presence. Like, I don't think I'm going to convert to Orthodox Judaism, but spiritual, not so much in a religious sense, but just this feeling of being at peace with the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's not Orthodox Judaism so much as esoteric Fordism.
Correct, but, yeah.
I really and truly did, too. I want to emphasize that. I know it sounds silly, and I know the moral leader stuff is very tongue-in-cheek in the documentary, and I'm not even saying that Luke is, a sage, per se, but just the human connection that I think we establish here, and the kind of the atmosphere of truth-telling and openness.
Yes, because really the thing about...
I kind of thought of it as... Luke did, to me, a very classic video, the 12 Steps of Alt-Right Anonymous, and I was like, this is the first official meeting of Alt-Right Anonymous right here.
Oh, yes, and that Serenity Prayer was perfect, because basically the Serenity Prayer addresses all these issues of, knowing your limitations, and sometimes it can be extremely painful, figuring out what are your limitations. Like, maybe we won't achieve the status that we feel that we rightfully deserve. Maybe we should just be content, just doing the creative process for the art itself. Maybe we should give up our kind of dreams and delusions of grandeur. And then, I mean, that's basically what the Serenity Prayer addresses, and it can be a hard pill to take.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ideal state for me as an artist would be to not be concerned about the outcome of my art or what it would get me, but just doing it for the process, but then also having it have a huge effect. It's almost like that would be the ideal. Like, focus, not worrying about what it's gonna do for me or do for the world. Just focusing on the craft and then trusting that that is going to lead you to a serene place of creating good work, and then trusting in that work's quality.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Matthew Pegas for being on. Just, it was really great working with you on this project.
Yeah, likewise, Robert. It's been awesome.